Do a public hearing on Senate Bill. What is this thing? I need my glasses.
704.
704. Public hearing.
You have a matter of voting in your hearing, you're ignoring her.
Go ahead, Senator. Don't mind the distraction.
You mean, don't mind the fact that Senator Duncan is ignoring me like usual? He didn't hear me. Shall I insult him again?
Please don't make Senator Duncan angry. He's a critical member of the
committee. Yes, I realize that.
President, we're going to hear from the trespasser. I'm a debtor.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the committee and yourself taking time to address this bill. This is a small bill, but it is of importance to some of my constituents as well as to most religious organizations around the state. Most of you probably don't remember, as I don't remember so well myself, that last session the legislature passed a bill that changed the process for certifying clergy persons to come into the state of Oregon to perform marriages. It's a fairly common practice that a minister might reside and work in one state most of the time, but then might be invited to come to another state to perform an individual marriage ceremony. Previously, the responsibility for certifying this person to perform the marriage rested with the county clerk in the county where the marriage was to be performed. The county clerks objected to this practice, however, because they felt they were not in a position to be making the determination about who was qualified to perform a marriage. So in 1999, we changed the law so that the local branch, understand this, the local branch of each clergy person's church would have to certify them instead of the clerks at the county level certifying them. What this means is that if you want to come to Oregon to perform a marriage, you have to get an affidavit of authority to perform marriages from the main state office of your church in Oregon. Unfortunately, this process has created a great deal of additional paperwork for the local church offices, and that is what we wish to reconcile with this bill. This bill would delete the requirement to file, quote, the affidavit of authority to perform marriages and replace it with a requirement that the clergy person who performed the marriage return to the county clerk after the marriage with an appropriate certificate detailing by whom they are authorized to perform marriage ceremonies. To the best of my knowledge, there's no opposition to the bill, and I hope you'll support it. Thank you again for taking time to look at the bill, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
Senator, you said that county clerks previously had a role in this. They didn't want that.
County clerks did not want the role of trying to figure out who was a legitimate minister and who wasn't a legitimate minister, and therefore they tried to pass it on to the denominations. But in the process, whenever the denomination made that determination, they would have to run to a notary of the public and get it all notarized, and it became a paperwork mess that you'd be surprised the number of, for instance, Presbyterian ministers, since we are picking on Senator Duncan today, come in from out of state to do one marriage a year, you know, Methodist, Catholic, whoever, when they come in from another state, that judicatory has to do a bunch of paperwork related to it. And the bill that's in front of you simply makes some changes that simplifies it. It simply kind of says a clergyman of any religious congregation or organization who is authorized by the congregation or organization to solemnize marriages can do it. Now, I happened to bring with me, and this was just some of my kind of, I don't know if it's creative or uncreative thinking, but I brought some certificates. These are actually marriage licenses that I brought along. And at the bottom of the marriage license right now is a little place where I would sign my name as a clergyman, and underneath it, it's the county where my authority to do a marriage is recorded. All right? You can still do that kind of thing. You would simply change the form, and this the bill that's in front of you has potential kind of, well, first it deletes the old affidavit of authority, but if you go into the bill, farther back, it has kind of a form that's there in, toward the back of the bill. I guess I better look it up on the regular bill if you want to see it. And this could just be made a part of the marriage license, okay? It's as simple as adding the line that they've added. For instance, this is a Multnomah County marriage license that I have, and it's on page 4 of the bill, lines 1 to 19, or it could be any shortened version of that that you want. You could have a one-line version of this certificate that we developed here.
So, Senator, who's going to develop the form?
In the past, it's been done by the counties. Okay, it's just a part of the marriage license. This suggests a form that they may use. It doesn't require them to use it. It would give them some guidance if they want.
Right. So the county, it would be up to the counties. They would.
Yeah.
They would incur any cost, I assume.
Right. And I don't think it'd incur much cost. I was looking at the difference, for instance, between the 99 form and the 2000 form in Multnomah County, and there are changes. I mean, in the 99 form, line 26A is by the time you get to the 2000 form, line 32 or 33. So they change these forms regularly.
All right. So help me along with this because
sure.
you've been a minister for a long period of time. But we have a Church of Elvis in Portland. Could that person perform a marriage and then fill out the form and solemnize it?
As I understand it, the Church of Elvis is already able to do marriages.
It is. All right.
This doesn't change their status.
All right.
What they were trying to do when they changed the law in 99 was to take away from the county clerks the job of certifying that every minister that flew in from out of state to marry their niece or nephew or whoever was legitimately certified.
So,
and they didn't want to do that job anymore, and so they gave it to the church denominations to do it.
Okay. And under your particular plan, the minister would go ahead and conduct the marriage.
Right.
And then file the paperwork. And how do you determine, mm-hmm. who determines then whether it's the minister's not
okay.
that minister or not?
They have to, with this form, certify where they have their authority to perform marriages. I'm moving stuff around too much here, maybe to keep track of it all. But it just replaces it with the requirement that the clergy person who performed the marriage return to the county clerk after the marriage with an appropriate certificate detailing by whom they are authorized to perform the marriage.
Okay, but if I decided I wanted to conduct a marriage, could I go fill out one of these forms? And
well, you would have to get your judicatory to say that you were authorized to do it. All right, you would. I mean, it would happen internal. For instance, in the United Methodist Church, we certify our ministers in our denominations to perform all the sacraments.
Non-denominational churches, ones that aren't affiliated with a particular denomination.
They are congregations that they're basically two kinds of polities in church government. There's episcopal polity, which means that they have some kind of structure with bishops and so on. And then there's a congregational polity, and a congregational church is a body that certifies its own pastors and ordains them and so on. And so the congregation would then ordain their person.
All right. So and they do that under the structure of whatever filings they have for their mm-hmm. tax-exempt statuses and
right.
corporate filings or whatever. Okay. Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's kind of interesting the way people can get licensed to perform marriages. I went to a wedding one time in my county. An MD, I didn't know the person, but an MD had sent away for the authority, a license as a minister, and had filed with the state. So he was licensed to perform the ceremony. The problem was he didn't show up at the wedding, and there happened to be a Presbyterian minister from California there, and it was on a Sunday. I remember they asked me, well, so they went ahead and did the ceremony, and I was going to try to find the county clerk afterwards. But thank goodness the other guy did show up right at the very end and signed the statements. I mean, it's kind of a Like anybody can send away to get a license.
And
as a minister, and then file with the county clerk.
You're right, and I'm not an authority on this particular point in the law, but I understand any person in Oregon, any person can, I think it's once a year, go to the county clerk and get the authority to perform a marriage.
Right.
So that ostensibly even Senator Courtney could perform a marriage.
That's scary.
That is. We got to do something about that. We have a dash ones on this.
Please. I wanted him not to rush in when you finished your story, because I assume you wanted to see what effect your soliloquy would have on us.
So no, I'm just, as a matter of fact,
I want you to go take it further.
I just Senator want, Mr. Chair, I want you to know, someone can send away and get a certificate as a minister.
Do you feel good about what you told us? I mean,
it seemed to me the other chair wasn't aware of that.
Okay, thank you.
And he needed some knowledge, I thought.
Right.
Senator Harper, did you have your...
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. So we are trading an affidavit, a piece of paper, for a signature block on the certificate. It says Frank Shield qualified to perform marriages in North Carolina or something like that. Is that what we're saying, Frank?
Yes. You could do any...
Something like that.
Yeah. In the document, as I said, on page 4, lines 1 to 19... We give a sample of a form that you could use.
Okay.
Some counties may use a half a page form. I remember when I moved to Oregon, I moved to Klamath County. And the requirement for me as a minister when I moved to Klamath County was that I had to go to the courthouse, had to tell them that I was an ordained minister and prove that I was an ordained Methodist minister. And I signed my authority to do weddings once. Ever since, even though I live in Klamath County and have lived in Klamath County or Multnomah County for 20-some years, there is still a form on this wedding marriage license right here that I'm holding, and it says county where my authority is recorded, and I always write Klamath County because that's the county where I got where my authority to do the wedding is recorded.
But now you have a restriction. You can only marry relatives this time, right?
Huh?
You can only marry relatives now.
No. Excuse me. Can I try to clarify something?
Senator Shields,
if I could pull this committee back together, since obviously I won't finish that sentence.
Is it pretty well done? Are you happy, Senator Harper?
Sir, I'm
I think here. Probably you're the only one signed up on the bill, right? High and Supreme Legal Counsel. You really want to continue?
I want to say one thing.
By all means, please.
Okay. The change is that it now becomes the denomination that keeps kind of the archive of who is entitled to do a marriage rather than the county keeping an archive of who is qualified to do the marriage. So that in the Catholic Church, the Catholic structure would keep that database. In my Methodist church, the Methodist office would keep that database, and the Presbyterian church, they would keep, you know, and so on. The county just wanted out of the business. They didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do the paperwork, and this changes it effectively.
Okay. Further questions or comments for Senator Shields, who's just spoken extensively on his bill and now for also written testimony. Mr. Stagner, you want to come forward?
Mr. Shields, one quick question.
Yes. Bob, you want to stand? I want you to say, Frank, could you stay there? Because I want, these are competing religions here, so I'd sort of like to see you at the table at the same time. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I have a question. When marriages are performed, oftentimes at the end, you know, I now pronounce you, by the authority vested in me as a minister of the gospel and by the state of Oregon. Okay. That person would not. Would they be
sure that the state
have the authority at that?
The state in this bill is saying we recognize that authority. We're just making the denominations keep the records.
So, but still,
yeah, it doesn't change that. It's just a matter of who does the paperwork, whether it's the county clerks or.
No, I didn't.
Rob Bob can explain it to you.
I All right, Mr. Stagley, you did not sign up, but you came in and you, somehow you got the word to us, you want to talk on this. So do you want to say something on Senate Bill 704, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference and a brother in the faith.
I don't want a lot of male bonding going on with these guys. Just give us the position, please, of the church, and he's, you know, just start getting real close and cozy. I don't go for that stuff. So just do it straight up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I have not had a chance to share this information with Senator Shields. I did just get off the phone with Father Maslowski of the Archdiocese, who's in charge of pastoral services for the Archdiocese, and I read him the language and the effect of the amendments in terms of deleting affidavits of authority to perform marriages, etc. We would appreciate the opportunity to discuss this bill and the amendments that it makes to the marriage laws with Senator Shields, because there are concerns from a pastoral perspective about having official records and affidavits about who is authorized to perform marriages. So it's not as simple as we thought it might be, but there are considerable pastoral complications that we could see from our perspective. So we'd appreciate the opportunity to dialogue with Senator Shields about this to see if any of our concerns could be addressed.
Any questions, comments, or concerns for His Holiness?
I have a question.
Yes.
What are the concerns? I mean, you want to dialogue with him about the concerns, but I'm curious what they are.
I think that's funny.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, from our perspective, we really do want some sort of official record of an authorization to perform marriages, and also current law provides an affidavit of revocation of authority to perform marriages. Those provisions would be deleted by the proposed amendments. And if someone were at one past time authorized to perform marriages, but then is no longer authorized, there would be no official record of that in a county record.
Okay, we got the nitty-gritty. Thank you.
Further questions, concerns? Thank you, Mr. Stagner. Thank you, Senator Shields.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to testify on Senate Bill 704? Hearing's closed.
I got
Mr. Spahn, I kind of wanted to go on.
Shredder woman is here.
No.
Okay, I'm going to go to Senate Bill 647, which I believe they're here for that, even though they're not signed up, so we need to know what they're here for. We're about to find out what they're here for. Are we in Senate Bill 647? Is that why?
Mr. Chair, actually, I'm here on two bills, but I would like Representative Merkley to get back to doing the people's business. So if we could do Senate Bill 647 first, I would be very appreciative.
Oh, fine. Sure. We could do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I am honored and delighted to make my first appearance in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee today on behalf of Senate Bill 647. This is a fairly simple little bill that apparently is raising a lot of hackles in the back of the room. But last session we took the defensive approach and made crime of identity theft with stiff penalties. And also this legislation addresses the core of the problem and attempts to prevent the crime of identity theft, and also would help prevent check fraud, which is a huge problem in the state of Oregon. And the way it would do it is by requiring both businesses and government agencies to dispose of materials that include people's personal, financial, medical, tax information, that those records be either deleted or shredded before the materials are put into the trash or the dumpster. And basically what has happened is that dumpster divers frequently go through the large dumpsters you see out back of office buildings or the Capitol or apartment buildings, and go through the dumpsters and get people's financial information and then use that information to commit either an identity theft crime or a check fraud crime. I have absolutely no pride of authorship in this bill. I did not write it. Legislative counsel did. I do believe if we are going to require people to shred or dispose of technical financial information or personal information appropriately, there should be some kind of penalty. Otherwise, it's simply a paper tiger. Ha, 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 ha. You didn't even get it.
So anyway,
Mr. Chair, I understand that there's a lot of folks in the room that are either concerned that the language is too broad or too narrow, for example, as it concerns medical information. I'm happy to put a little work group together and bring the parties together and see if we can't work out some of these issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Representative Merkley, you've come here today from the House. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Would you like to enter a statement on the record at this time? Could you wait for questions, please, Senator Brown, or do you have to leave right away?
I do not have to leave, Mr. Chair.
But that, sir, Representative Merkley, please tell us what the Cardinal thinks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Cardinal is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Still back on the other bill, huh? We're still back on the other bill?
Stanford. Pay attention, Senator. Excuse me, Representative Brown Merkley, you just need to move ahead. You do not stop. And we're sure. The Senate Judiciary Committee.
Not stopping. We're ignoring you.
Very good.
You go right ahead.
Well, I think you're all aware that personal information today is being collected, collated, sorted, and sold in ever-increasing quantities. And we're seeing this really as the outflow of three technologies, of copier technology, of communication and data processing technology, and genetic technology. And I know this committee has been wrestling on the genetic side with personal privacy and genetic research. This bill addresses both the electronic medium and the paper medium, and essentially is one more front on the multifaceted personal privacy challenge we face in the context of a dramatically changing world. In combination, these technologies are collapsing our sphere of personal privacy, and I think it's the responsibility of the legislature to think about how we can restore that sphere or protect that sphere. And so I create that broad vision as a way of placing this bill as part of a number of strategies that we're capable of pursuing. I know that I can relate to this bill because the basic element of that's in here of shredding and or cleaning disks is one that I've encountered myself a year and a half ago. I went through the process of having to shut down all my bank accounts as a result of a forgery. And a forgery that I had to conclude as I thought about it probably came from the rating of my trash out at the curb. And we are seeing that this is, in fact, a challenge. So I purchased a shredder, and now every little document we receive that has our names on it, we shred it, particularly credit card applications, because I see I think I was fortunate to get off with a check forgery and not somebody simply taking one of those applications and using the information on it to take over my identity and take out a card and run up a big bill and destroy my credit background. So just as we on a personal basis are pursuing this, and as individuals certainly have the challenge of protecting their personal privacy in their day-to-day lives, those entities in society that control and manage our personal information have a responsibility to also protect our personal privacy. And so this bill tackles that. It's probably needs to be massaged and worked, but it's easy to say that something is too broad or too expensive or too soon. The assault on personal privacy is here today, and this is one tactic that we can take in helping ordinary citizens out. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Merkley, Senator Harper.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, Jeff. I appreciate you bringing this up, but slightly disturbed that we are going after innocent people instead of going after the people that are causing the crime. I'd be much more comfortable if we double, triple, quadruple, whatever the penalties are, but go after the guilty folks instead of the innocent people.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I guess I would liken this to the responsibility that I as a lawyer feel, or I think that medical personnel feel in terms of how we deal with people's legal records or their medical records. Obviously, those are confidential. We go to great lengths to preserve our clients' privacy and are very careful about how those records are disposed of after a 10-year period after the case is closed. So as a lawyer, I see it as part of my duty to my client in terms of how I deal with their information. Frankly, I agree with you in terms of going after the folks that commit identity theft or check fraud, and as I said earlier, we did impose penalties for identity theft last session. What this does, though, is help prevent those crimes before they begin. And you'll see here the penalty is imposed as an Unlawful Trade Practices Act. As I said earlier, I'm not committed to that particular means of redress, though I do think that folks are entitled to some type of remedy when a business that is dealing with your personal financial information, for example, your tax accountant, simply throws papers in their dumpster, and anybody, any Tom, Dick, or Sue can walk by and get that information out of the dumpster. So I think business people, and I do think public bodies, have a responsibility to the public and to their customers about how they deal with private personal information.
Mr. Chair, if I could add a few comments. I'd largely like to echo Senator Brown's thoughts, but I see this as simply an extension of good stewardship. When we are involved in a financial relationship, we have many, many guidelines for how we manage that information and the obligation we have to our customer. This simply says that in between the time that we have completed that financial relationship and we can dispose of the records, in that short additional time, we should extend our stewardship to the protection of our customer or our former customer. So I don't see it as a dramatic shift in the way we view the stewardship of involved in a transaction that involves personal information. And I do want to emphasize that we should go after identity theft vigorously. Unfortunately, when we're going after it, the damage has already been done, and sometimes it takes families literally years to recover. Extending good stewardship a bit further, if it can prevent those cases, is something that improves the quality of life for a lot of people.
Senator Burdick.
Chairman, I was out of the room for a moment, so I apologize if this came up before. Under current law, has anyone whose records have been taken in a scenario like this, has anyone brought civil lawsuits against people who disclose the records to your knowledge?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, not that I'm aware of.
And again, I know this came up. These are civil penalties on here. They look like civil penalties.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I had that conversation with legislative counsel whether to establish criminal penalties for the violators or civil penalties. This was the remedy that they chose in terms of I chose civil and that they picked the Unlawful Trade Practices Act language. I didn't feel like a criminal penalty was appropriate under the circumstances.
Not a C felony? Come on.
Yeah, so we're not a C felony.
Yeah, that's right.
We got a quota to fill.
No, we're good.
Senator Beyer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the person who sponsored the bill last session that criminalized identity theft and worked it through the process, and it wasn't an easy thing to do, but at that time I was very careful to make sure we didn't go down this road because of the baggage that brings on the bill. On the issue, and there was many people who wanted this sort of approach at that time. But what we did instead was, number one, we made it not a property crime. That crime of identity theft is a person crime, so there are stiffer penalties on the crime itself. And as a person who, in the last interim, I had mail stolen out of my mailbox. In that mail was personal checks, and we are still working on that. There's also several campaign checks, and fortunately we were able to catch those before someone else cashed them. But I mean, I guess I agree with Senator Harper that it would not be my intent to go after innocent parties when we just have created this. I'm a firm believer the market works and people will walk with their vote with their feet, and if there's someone business out there not doing responsible things, that's going to get out and people are going to no longer use that business. And I'm concerned about this because I don't think every time we place another burden on business or government, it drives the cost up to the ultimate consumer, and that is us and the people we represent. So I'm very concerned about this approach at this time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I appreciate those comments. I think the reason I felt comfortable in terms of moving forward with this approach is that, for example, shredders now are so cheap and it's so easy for people to do this. I mean, shredders are easily $15 to $20 at your local Office Depot. And so it's a fairly simple thing that we're asking people to do. And I don't think that everyone has the awareness of how easy it is to access this information in your local dumpster. So, but I do appreciate your concerns.
Okay, what remedies are available now under existing law if someone misuses information obtained out of a dumpster, financial information, medical information, or
person crime?
Well, okay, identity theft, person crime, a misdemeanor. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure. There, it's expanding upon, you know, the first violation is less, and then I don't have the statute right in front of me, but it's escalating.
But are there any civil penalties if someone's actually harmed financially or
get into that? You know? I do know that in my own case, when my mail was stolen, the person that did it, I think it was just prosecuted. Well, they've been trying to prosecute now for almost, you know, going on 2 years. The person wasn't showing up for court and what have you. But he actually, it's very frustrating because I think it was in 97 we tried to make mail theft a state crime, and the governor vetoed that bill. So there's nowhere to go when you need your mail, because the post office says, well, we don't have the manpower to do anything about it. You can't get the federal people involved. So it ended up being there was no crime against Barb and I because no one would prosecute it. So it ended up going to the bank, who actually covered the stolen checks, and they were able to prosecute for fraud against the bank. You know, so there are things we can do, like Senator Harper said, that we can, you know, go after guilty people and leave the innocent alone.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Duncan.
The only question I might have would be, and I agree with Senator Harper and Senator Beyer on that part of it, but I guess what assurance do I have right now that people with whom I do business, and I know you say, well, if I find out, I shouldn't trade with them anymore, but I guess I'd want to be sure that the bank and so forth isn't throwing my information out. So I'm looking at protection for me, and I'm just wondering how we... It seems to me like this does address that concern, that for my protection, I mean, I'm not trying to protect... You've already dealt with the perpetrator. I mean, that's something else. I'm talking about how I'm affected by what they do. So that's the only reason I would raise the question of what might be done there.
All right.
And I do know, but I did just happen to catch a television show one time. It was showing you what they had somebody who had done this sort of thing, stealing the stuff, and he was piecing together out of the trash, and he told the whole story about these people he could put together just through their trash. It was amazing what kind of information they can gather. And I frankly would never have looked at trash quite the same way that guy did.
Well, that's where the cops that we go dumpster diving all the time.
Information.
Stuff. It's public. Staff, your counsel was telling me that this is a Class C felony. What is a Class C felony?
Identity theft is a Class C felony.
Each.
But we did it right. We made it a
Mr. felony. Chair, according to Senator Beyer, it was classified as a person crime for probably sentencing guideline purposes. So,
that's
it helps.
That's correct. You know, it starts, it just flat out is a Class C felony, or is it starting with some
misdemeanor? It's just flat out.
It's a flat-out classy. I like that. Okay.
Pretty simple. Simple and clean.
Senator Metzger.
Well, you know, this is interesting. I think there's a consideration that has to be applied, though, and maybe we get some more additional legal information on this. Consideration applied to those who carelessly allow our information to fall in the hands of someone who may use it inappropriately. I mean, we've had that discussion just a few weeks ago, as we will be having more on genetic privacy, where there is a crime for using DNA, but we're also discussing the crime of someone who carelessly allows that information to penalties to fall into the hands of someone else. And I would think it would be appropriate, and certainly with the public body, you know, if someone carelessly has vital information about Senator Harper, Senator Beyer, and your personal information, financial information, yes, there would be you want to go after the person who might misuse it. But if the fact that they got access to it because, you know, we were careless in throwing this information out into a dumpster in which the whole world could find it, you know, that would seem to me to generate something appropriate for some type of cause of action for carelessly taking my identity information and allowing it to be used by someone who was coming into the dumpster or whatever. Say we've talked about this before, and we'll be talking about it again when that genetic bill comes back, and we had ample discussion about, you know, there's going to be penalties if you're careless with information so that it may fall in the wrong hands. And, you know, this is a printed information of the same type of thing, and I would think there would be some consistency there. I think certainly as a public body, on the public body standpoint, I mean, maybe if I know that, you know, my bank is doing bad information, and I do remember as a reporter when Eric Mason did that story with First Interstate Bank and went out to the dumpster and, oh, here's Steve Harper, and read all about his bank accounts and everything else. That didn't make you feel too good. Wasn't you, Steve? I just used you as an example, Colonel.
Nothing there. Steal everything I own.
That was an issue there, but I mean, if we can extrapolate that a little further and look at, say, from a public body, if you gave information for whether it be to, you know, the employment department or agriculture department, and carelessly someone in that agency allowed that information, whether it be at your personal use or your business, and was careless about that so that it fell in the wrong hands, I think we would feel that there was an obligation on the state to take better care. So I think the principle, I think, is a valid one. Now, whether it's written exactly, and I'm sure we'll hear other people tell us exactly how to do that, but I think there is a custodial care question here that is valid.
Mr. Chair, if I could add a comment.
Hang on. If there's anybody in the audience that's waiting for 667, we're not going to get to that today. So I don't want, if you're there and you're waiting for it, you know, anticipation of having a good conversation about it, we're not going to deal with it today. So you're free to go.
Well, I'd like to note that one can think about it like this. You take your car in to have it repaired, and you're going to come back later and pick it up. So you have an extra key, or you make arrangements to pick up the key or something of this nature. But surely the person repairing the car is not going to simply say, I'm going to leave this sitting out here and put the key in it. Yes, if someone comes along and steals it, you can say, well, let's punish the person who stole it. But it was bad stewardship for a person to set the car out there with a key in it. Identity theft and other frauds of identity that are lesser or different from full identity theft are such an increasing problem in our society that basically we're saying, when you throw away your records, don't do it in a careless fashion. Don't leave the key sitting in the car for someone to steal the car. Honor that relationship and your the fact that you are a steward of people's personal information.
All right, and actually, Representative Merkley and I attended a conference where this topic was raised, and this may be a little premature for the Oregon legislature right now, but I think based on what both Representative Merkley and I saw coming from the federal government and some of the issues that they're beginning to see in terms of internet crimes and the identity theft issue and what's coming out of that will probably blow most of our minds in terms of the innovativeness of fraud criminals. But we don't have the group of people here today that could explain, I think, the situation. I mean, I tend to agree that to some extent where you have somebody who just carelessly dumps medical information or personal information in a dumpster. See, criminals are generally smarter by accident than they are on purpose, and they know that they can find information like this in dumpsters because people throw them out that way, thinking that that's perfectly okay to do. So, because there is no law against it or no potential, you know, punishment, I guess, for not doing it appropriately. So we're going to have more conversations, I think, in this committee about fraud crimes in general, since I'd like to see us have a Measure 11 type of, you know, sentencing matrix for people who are career fraud criminals.
Mr. Chair, and I know you missed my statement, but I know there are a plethora of people in the back of the room with either specific concerns or just general concerns about the bill. If the chair wishes, and as an approach that Senator Bryant took last session, I'm happy to try and pull a work group together and see if we can come up with an approach. I don't know if it would, however, satisfy the colonel's concerns. I know he's only the junior colonel on this committee, and Senator Byers' concerns, but I just put that out there in case
right.
That's an approach you'd wish to take.
Thank you, Senator Bryant. Any other questions?
Thank you
very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Charlie Williams.
You finally got to her.
I got to
her. I'd be glad to just participate in the work group and spare you my testimony unless you want me to.
Well, you
go
represent
ahead.
Commercial information systems, though, and that kind of intrigues me.
Well, I'm just, yeah, my name is Charles Williamson. I'm an attorney from Portland. I represent commercial information systems. I'm not sure we particularly have any of this type of information that this bill affects, but it does concern us that what the bill, one of the effects of this bill is to take records which could have been public records. Anybody could have walked in off the street and looked at them and taken copies as part of their business. And then it puts a obligation on them to dispose of them in a certain way, which they had no knowledge of when they got the records. And it applies really retroactively to everybody that's ever gotten a public record that has this in it. So it seems to me that the bill shouldn't cover things that are in the public domain, that newspapers have published and so forth. I mean, and so, all of this stuff, while it's generally private, if someone sues about their medical condition, it's in the complaint, it's got evidence in court. If a bank needs to sue somebody to collect on a credit card, the balance and the credit limit and the account number might well be in the public record. And once it's in the public record, trying to say that everybody that ever got it has to dispose of it in a certain way is trying to close the barn door after the horses escaped. And I guess that I'd be glad to work with Senator Brown to try and fix this because we agree with the concept. We don't want people hurt by information, and we serve mainly law enforcement and insurance companies, the legal profession, banks. We don't sell information to the public at large, but generally legitimate businesses only. And so we agree with the concept, but we think it needs work.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Brown, I'll get back with you on possible work group on this issue. And kind of have a dialogue with some of my Republican colleagues here.
Just translate down the face of the woodshed.
Anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 647 would like to?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
As a clarification, was public body one of the phrases that we referenced in that big bill that we talked about and changing the names?
Changing the names.
And that the bar kept themselves out of and they said they weren't, didn't apply to them.
And we might want to reference that statute. And
yeah. Statute. Just curious, was that part of, because yes. That
public body was one of the definitions that was included in that bill.
So then,
but it's not law yet.
Did that mean all governmental agencies? I don't remember.
Yeah. I think we'd have to go back and look at that legislation.
Yes, it has a really broad definition. It includes, goes out to almost everything.
That's what that meant. Public bodies, including the area state.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 647 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 773. And Kate, Senator Brown, you're back up again. Mr. Kramer?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7, and I'm here actually to just introduce Mark Kramer to testify in support of Senate Bill 773. Mark is a constituent of mine and has been involved in juvenile court cases over the years, as have I, and I'm personally familiar with the case that this bill is in response to, and I would simply ask you to take a look at it. I think it's about preserving children's rights and making sure our kids are treated appropriately. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Kramer, excuse me.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mark Kramer. My address is 520 Southwest 6th Avenue, Suite 1010, Portland 97204. I'm a Portland attorney. I have a private practice that focuses family law, and a significant portion of my practice is representation of parents, foster parents, grandparents, and third parties in juvenile court cases. That's where the state has established wardship over children, and the court usually gives legal custody of the children to the State Office for Services to Children and Families, better known as SCF. I asked Senator Brown to sponsor Senate Bill 773 because there's a terrible void in our current tort claims notice statute. Under our current law, a specific written notice must be given to public bodies prior to filing a lawsuit against the public body or its employees or its agents. Now, in most cases, the deadline is 6 months. There's an additional 90 days in the case of minors, up to a period of 270 days, and in the case of a wrongful death, the limit is 1 year. If you don't file that notice, you lose your right to file a lawsuit. This is very different from what we call the statute of limitations. That's the period in which you actually have to file your lawsuit, and when we're talking about a claim against a public body, that is 2 years, and nothing in this bill affects the statute of limitations. Now, the tort claims notice provision is very important. It's got a number of purposes. One is to permit the public body to commence an investigation of the alleged claim while the evidence is there and witnesses are available. It allows the public body to negotiate before a lot of expensive litigation costs occur. And it puts the public body on notice. So if there's a problem, maybe we can take some remedial action. So those are all good things. In a typical case involving a minor, a guardian ad litem is appointed by the court. If my child gets involved in a motor vehicle accident, I would apply to the court to be his guardian ad litem, and I would go to the court and represent his interests and get an attorney for him. The appointment doesn't happen automatically. Someone has to go on behalf of the child and get that status. The problem with the current law is that there is no one who's specifically obligated to give such notice when a child is in the custody of a public body. While some children for short periods are in the custody of a county authority, the vast majority of cases we're talking about children in SCF or in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. And here's the problem. A child in the custody of SCF or OYA who is injured by a public body has no one to give notice for him or for her. Now, recently, civil rights attorney Eldon Rosenthal and I concluded litigation in a case called Fellows versus Coombs. The case was brought on behalf of a baby, a deceased child, her estate, and her surviving brother. The baby was murdered by her mother in the presence of her brother. Both children were in legal custody of SCF. Wardship had been established. The mother was mentally retarded and had lost three prior children to the system. The state had notice from two psychologists that this mother was unfit to parent alone, and nevertheless, the state maintained custody, physical custody of these children with the mother. Ultimately, the state conceded negligence, and the case settled with the plaintiffs for $1 million. The child's attorney was also sued and settled with the plaintiffs. Now, here's what happened. During the course of the litigation, the state said that the case should be dismissed because we didn't file a tort claims notice on behalf of the surviving brother. It went in front of Judge Cantor in Multnomah County, and he said that the legislature would not impose upon the child, in these circumstances, the obligation to give notice to the state. Judge Cantor said this is consistent with the policy of the state that recognizes that children are individuals who have legal rights. And I've attached Judge Cantor's ruling to this opinion. Judge Cantor said in his opinion that he was faced with a very difficult challenge, and that is trying to figure out the legislature's intent. as to whether a minor is required to give a tort claims notice when there is no effective parent, custodian, or guardian with a duty to give that notice. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is the challenge, and this is the reason the bill comes before you. As drafted, the bill would exempt minors under the age of 18 from being required to give such a notice if the claim is against a public body that had custody of the child when the claim arose. Now, in reviewing the bill with Senator Brown, it came to my attention that the bill didn't totally solve the problem because it only pertains to claims against that body that had custody. In other words, it would apply to a child in the custody of SCF, but only if the child sued SCF. If the child was in the custody of SCF but was harmed by the Oregon Youth Authority, was harmed by a county person, was harmed by an adult and family services person, unfortunately, as it stands, this bill would not help. Now, this isn't fair, and it's not just. If you determine that there is a compelling reason to exempt children from filing a tort claims notice, it's because they're in state custody and they can't do it. Therefore, it shouldn't matter whether the claim is against SCF or OIA or Department of Transportation. Now, a Dash 1 amendment has been prepared which would change the bill and apply the exemption to all claims against public bodies, but only, again, where a public body had custody of the child when the claim arose. And, again, that's because the child is unable to file a claim. What is the effect of the bill? This bill is to ensure that meritworthy cases where a child has been harmed by a public body see the light of day. It doesn't mean there's going to be more lawsuits. A lawsuit still is going to have to be filed within 2 years. It certainly doesn't mean that any lawsuit's going to be any more successful. Believe you me, the state's attorneys are aggressive, and they employ every legal strategy in the book to defeat or narrow such claims. But for those meritworthy cases that would otherwise be thrown out or dismissed because the lack of this piece of paper, the lack of this notice, yes, this bill would allow those cases to proceed. And where the evidence is compelling, damages would be paid. But that's not a reason to criticize this bill. We have a duty to ensure that children harmed by the state or any other public body or agent have their rights protected to pursue those claims by appropriate individuals. Anything less would be to aggravate the harm already perpetuated on the child. First, the child's removed from the parent and placed in state care. Then the child is harmed by someone, some public entity, and is left with no legal recourse to pursue the claim. I would urge you to approve this bill with the Dash 1 amendment, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Senator Burdick?
Chairman, what is the purpose of the tort claim notice?
The purpose? It's to put the state on guard, on notice early, that there may be a lawsuit coming against you. Maybe we can settle the case. They certainly want to investigate the case, and if something is terribly wrong with a policy or procedure, we'd like to fix it. So that's the overall purposes.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. So if, to follow up, if you took away that requirement for children, then what impact would that have on the state's rights to have these other options that they have with the filing of the notice in most cases?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, in the typical case, for example, in the case that I litigated, a child was murdered, another child was harmed, the state knew what happened. There are internal processes in SCF. In the case of a county detention, if a child is assaulted by an officer, then a report must be filed. So the county still has notice. It does not is not going to get necessarily the same type of notice as a tort claims notice, which, by the way, wouldn't go to SCF or wouldn't go to a county or wouldn't go to the Department of Transportation. It goes to the state. It goes to the risk management in the state, and it's funneled off to an attorney general.
Follow up. Is there another alternative approach that would be possible that would still give the state notice? I mean, it's one thing to know they did something wrong. It's another thing to know they're being sued by it. Is there another alternative way that they could be informed? So it seems to me it would be in the interest of the child in some cases to have settlement discussions proceeding in an early stage. So is there some alternative type of notice that would be possible?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, let me give you two potential remedies. In every case in which a child is in custody of the state, there's a juvenile court attorney. So we could say, Mr. and Ms. Juvenile Court Attorney, that's your job. You protect the child. But I can tell you what they're going to say. We've got enough problems representing the child in the juvenile court. We're not a civil rights attorney. We're not a litigation attorney. And usually our malpractice insurance doesn't cover us when we go outside our field. So please, please, please don't give us the job. We can't do it. We don't want it. Another remedy. Well, the state court has wardship over this child. They're legally in control. Well, we can tell our judiciary, it's your responsibility, Judge so-and-so, to protect this child, to investigate a claim. Well, I can tell you what the juvenile court judges are going to say for that. We're overworked. We don't want their responsibility. We certainly don't want to be investigating potential claims against NCF or other authorities. So I'm sorry to say that, at least from my perspective, the other remedies of putting the job with someone else is impractical. And what Judge Cantor said is we could make SCF give notice to itself. And he said, well, that doesn't make any sense. SCF has to give notice to SCF of something that SCF did wrong. So at least Judge Cantor said that he didn't think that's what the legislature meant to happen.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, in terms of the bigger picture here, I am pleased to say that the agency at Services to Children and Families, in response to this particular lawsuit, has been fairly responsive to addressing Mr. Kramer's concerns from a prospective nature. And I've had conversations with Ramona Foley about this particular case, and I think they're working hard to make sure that their caseworkers receive the training that they need and that cases of concern are red flagged with bigger red flags than they're currently being red flagged for. So I do think that there has been some good that came out of this lawsuit in terms of the entire system.
Okay. I can appreciate that. Ramona Foley seems to be doing a very good job. And I guess I want to understand the legal glitch that you're identifying for us here. You have a child in custody of the state, either SCF or OIA, and they're harmed by
SCF's negligence or alleged negligence.
Right. And then where is it that the appropriate notice is not given? Obviously, the state doesn't give notice to itself.
Right.
Harmed someone.
The problem is that there's no one to give notice on behalf of the child under the Tort Claims Act. So if because the state has legal custody, technically speaking, you would think the state would be the one. That's not a possibility,
but
right?
Can someone else, some third party, apply for a guardian ad litem?
Right. Unfortunately, and this is legislation I've worked on for a couple of sessions, not all of the children in SCF or OIA custody have lawyers. So that's one issue. And even if they do have lawyers, folks like me who were trained in juvenile court don't have the expertise to file tort claims notices. And even if we did have the expertise, we don't necessarily have the malpractice insurance. And frankly, given the caseload that juvenile court attorneys have in these dependency cases, they're already extremely overworked. So that is not a very practical. A guardian ad litem would be appropriate if there were somebody there to request a guardian ad litem on behalf of the child.
And so obviously if you have a minor child who doesn't communicate, that becomes a problem.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right.
And obviously it would be weird for the judges to do it as well.
Senator Harper.
I want to back up a little bit. It does sound silly, SCF filing against itself, but SCF is not one person. They are the legal guardian. It would be a legal document that would put the whole system on notice. That, to me, is not that far-fetched.
Of course,
it sounds silly in the bar.
Yeah. But if the court recognized that as a defect, a non-filing of a tort claims notice, and they failed to do that, I mean, they could pretty much eliminate any potential lawsuit by not filing the tort claim notice on themselves, so to speak. Yeah.
That would be the proper procedure, though, the legal guardian, no matter who it is.
Right. Although if you have an action where you have a parent who has custody, and the parent is the person who might be the defendant in a suit who's harmed the child, then I assume there would be an attorney or someone who would ask for a guardian ad litem, for that guardianship to move the action forward. The whole thing seems kind of silly to me, that that somehow this would be a bar to actually accessing the courts. Seems kind of silly. Judge Cantor allowed this case to proceed, though.
But he cried out for some guidance from the legislature saying, there's no case law, and I don't know what they meant, so please tell me what they meant. And, Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, regarding SCF giving notice to itself, potentially it could occur if there's someone on the ground to perceive that there's a claim. If you're the caseworker and you're doing the best you can, maybe you're not recognizing if someone else thinks that your work is negligent. Maybe it's not a wrongful death. Maybe it's not a sex abuse case. So it's very hard to do that issue spotting. And Mr. Chairman and Senator Harper, just so you know, it may seem nonsensical, but the state of Oregon did argue in this case, dismiss this case, Your Honor, because we didn't give notice to ourselves, or because nobody gave notice to us.
And that sounds kind of ridiculous on its surface, but hey, what do I know? Okay, we've got other witnesses that want
thank
to
thank you, Chair.
Mike Hansen from Marion County. Maybe you can make sense of this for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm not sure I will make sense of everything, but I do have some points I want to make. My name is Mike Hansen, and I am Marion County Legal Counsel, but I am not here on behalf of Marion County. I was requested to appear on behalf of AOC, which has taken a position against this amendment. And I am a member of the Oregon County Counsel's Association Legislative Review Committee. And I came here basically to reiterate some points that were sent, I think, by a letter from John Gray, Yamhill County Counsel, on behalf of the Oregon County Counsel's Association. And we had two points we wanted to make and a footnote, I guess. And the first footnote was that this bill, as drafted, if applied, would be retroactive. So you should understand that the effect of this is going to apply to any claim where the statute of limitations has not expired and no final judgment has been entered. So it's not just simply a prospective application, but it's going to be retroactive to any claim that's still within that statute of limitations. We have several concerns about the Oregon Tort Claims Act in this issue. It's our understanding that the Oregon Tort Claims Act, basically, prior to its enactment, the state was immune from suit, and public bodies as well. The Oregon Tort Claims Act is adopted, and now the state has said that on behalf of the state and public bodies, individuals, you can now sue the state if you meet certain conditions. You've got to file your lawsuit within 2 years, and you've got to give us timely notice, and that notice time period is set out. And as pointed out here, in the case of a minor, you've got 90 days to run, and then from that point, another 180 days to give your notice, so a total of 270 days. If you don't give that notice, then it is a bar to litigation in the future. And it will always be true that some people will get timely notice and some won't, you know, for a variety of circumstances. But this is a rule that applies generally to everybody, and we have this additional time for someone, for example, who is a juvenile. This particular legislation, though, creates an exemption for a specific category, a specific situation. And our concern is if you create an exemption now, this legislative session, what exemptions will you be asked to create in the future? From my point of view, in terms of administering something like this and applying it, all I can tell you is I spend a good deal more time with the public records law than I would like. It seems to be a general rule that's riddled with so many exceptions that I begin to get a little frustrated administering that. We're a little concerned about maintaining the integrity of the Oregon Tort Claims Act if we now start amending this to deal with exceptions for specific situations as they come along. Also, Mr. Kramer was kind enough to point out that there are some good public policy purposes behind giving notice. There is, of course, the obvious defensive one from the point of view of a public body. You want to have notice of the claim so you can investigate. You can prepare to defend yourself or to settle that claim if that seems to be appropriate. Policies and how you deal with those claims are going to vary over time, just like they would for an insurance company. You're going to say no to everybody and make them sue you. You're going to try to settle everything up front and cheap or somewhere in between, perhaps. You know, you can't count on a particular technique, you know, for how you want to deal with those kind of defenses. But there is value to having that timely notice and being able to investigate and determine if the claim is valid and whether you should deal with it. So it's a big deal, I think, to counties and other local governments when that shield is going to be lowered a little further. it's an issue. There is the offensive side of this, I would say, and from that point of view, or affirmative side of the policy, in that if you have timely notice, not only do you investigate the claim from the point of view, how would you defend it as an attorney or a risk manager, it's an issue of knowing what's occurred. You're an employer, you're a public body, you have an obligation to people to deal with the situation. So if you have timely notice, if personnel actions are required, you can take those. If there are issues with your policies or your programs, you can deal with those. Finding out 2 years later won't necessarily be as much help to you when you have litigation. And you have a possibility, depending on the circumstances, where perhaps you can mitigate the harm that is occurring to an individual.
Mr. Hansen,
some timely notice.
Mr. Hansen,
yes, Mr. Chair.
If I could, I mean, yeah. I understand what you're saying, and those are all good things with respect to the reasons why we have a tort claims notice.
Sure.
And so on and so forth. But I think the issue of the bill goes to the extent that there are certain individuals, because of their status or position or inability to communicate, who cannot file that claims notice. Well, tell me how a non-communicative child in the custody of SCF would be able to file a tort claims notice and meet this statutory requirement.
Non-communicative in the sense that what they are just simply physically unable, emotionally unable?
A three-year-old child who barely speaks, who's been abused by one of their parties or their parents or a third party.
There is going to be difficulty in that child, himself or herself, certainly being able to do that. You're right. There's always going to be that issue. That person's not going to be able to do it
themselves. The way I look at this is you do have a certain segment of population who, because of who they are and where they are incapable of actually complying with that tort claims notice filing, and that's where I'd like you to focus.
Right.
Because I mean, if you've got a remedy for how we can deal with that, then fine. I'd like to have that. But it seems to me that this does not provide justice to a child who's been harmed, who's not communicated, and in the custody of the state. And we're not providing the same privilege or right to that child we're providing every other citizen.
Points I think I probably would raise on that side is that I'm not sure you have to have a guardian ad litem in order to file a notice. You're not going to find a good deal of guidance in the Oregon Tort Claims Act on that issue. The child, certainly, when they are able to communicate, could file a notice. A parent could do that. Certainly the state could do that. And in some respects, if the state has custody, you're talking about a notice for a tort claim against another government body, let's say a county, or maybe let's say it's a city, because you have a child who's old enough to walk on the public streets. They trip over a crack in the sidewalk and they hurt themselves. The 1A amendment, as I understand it, would be that if a child is in the custody of any governmental body and they are harmed while in that custody by any other governmental body, you don't need to give notice. One example in this case. Why not? Okay, an example like that. And I know I'm going a little bit beyond your question specifically, but that broadens it way beyond the initial written language in front of you at the moment. But why wouldn't there be some notice able to be given by the child, by a parent, by one governmental body to another? There is also the potential here, and wasn't much discussion of this, and I do not know the circumstances of the case, but there's a special provision that talks about actual notice. It has to be actual notice to a governmental body by someone who's got the ability to deal with, investigate, and deal with claims in some fashion. It's not a perfect solution that's going to answer everyone's issue all the time, but there are many avenues by which notice would be given, and I think would be recognized by a public body. So that is one possibility. I'm a little concerned, frankly, when I've listened and had a chance to read through Mr. Kramer's testimony about the 1A amendment. I'm going to go back again and emphasize the example of, let's say a child is in the custody of the SCF, but they're not physically located in some confined circumstances. They're out in the street. You're walking on the street, you trip over a sidewalk that's owned by a city. Why shouldn't the city get notice as it normally would for that kind of a tort claim? Just because a child is in the custody of the SCF, does that really make a difference in that circumstance? It's very broad. I have another footnote that I would bring up just in passing. The word custody is used in this amendment. I'd say in the context of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, that word custody is just simply an ordinary word. The discussion here has been about formal legal custody of SCS of a child. But I would be careful with this language or concerned about it. Does this language really express that idea, and is that what we're talking about? Or would custody be viewed as more of a general term, which could be that formal legal custody, physical custody, or some kind of right to control less than that? by some governmental entity. It depends on what you want that word to mean, you know, and I'm not sure that the word as it's presented to you now is clear enough to deal only with the situation that's been presented, and that is the only intent here, but I would raise that issue. And as Chairman Minnis, I'd love to give you an absolute answer as far as saying that no child is non-communicative in the custody of SEF would ever be in a situation of having to worry about whether or not custody be given, but I can't give you that statement. I don't know enough about it. I do know that there are a variety of ways in which notice can be given that would be effective against a public body. And that's all I can say on that subject.
All right, sir.
So I've made my points. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to address them.
All right. Questions? Senator Metzger?
Yes. Thank you. We've heard some examples, and the chair has talked about this as well. We're talking about minors in this case. And they run the gamut, and the situations can be different, in which you're basically saying that a public body has to tell the public body that we've done something wrong, and making an assumption that that every minor child is going to be in a position to either know this or, for lack of fear, maybe not do something. You used an example on the other extreme, like, you know, tripping over sidewalks or whatever, and it sounds like you gave us a number of examples of where there might be some problems, but I'd like to go back to Mr. Kramer's point and say, do you, in terms of trying to find a solution to this problem and potential problems going forward, don't you believe that there would be an inherent conflict of interest, A, under the current statute, where someone was in physical custody, whether it's OYA or something was done inappropriately, wrong, harmful to an individual who may, in fact, might be fearful of doing anything because they are limited in doing that, plus their knowledge, plus they don't have anybody to act as their agent other than the agency itself that may have been a violator while that clock is ticking. And don't you think there is, in those types of cases, that we should look at seeing what we can do because there's as a duty to perform as a public body to ensure that they are protected, whether that is, you know, opening a window prospectively going forward or putting something in as some type of duty to perform that type of act. And don't you believe that when we're talking about minor children, and they could be extremely minor children, that is a different class of citizen than you and I, operating our own free will in an environment of notifying public bodies? It would seem to me that there is a extraordinary duty we would have here to make sure that these types of situations don't occur again.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, you've caught me in an area where I didn't come prepared to testify, so I'm going to speak off the top of my head on this subject a bit. You've raised a question that I think does deserve some attention. That is, do you have a class that you want to recognize here? The point I want to try to make, I think, and I do, and I represent ALC here, is I think to take some caution about starting to create exemptions from the current Oregon Tort Claims Act. Secondly, recognizing that I don't think the Oregon Tort Claims Act certainly is going to make sure that everyone always gives notice, but the perspective here is you have the ability. Generally, the Oregon Tort Claims Act does require that notice be given, but it allows that to be done. It isn't there to impose a duty on any particular individual or entity to give that notice. And actually, the way this bill is drafted, it would exempt that notice requirement in this category, and that's the way it would deal with it. I'm a little more concerned about, frankly, the amendments that would come up in terms of how far does that not giving notice go, how far does that extend? From the point of view of counties, I've got a real concern about that. If, in fact, we're not the ones with custody, that formal legal custody, someone has been in our detention facility or part of a program, for example, for a while, or is, in fact, in a county vehicle and is injured in some respect, and we're not getting the notice that we think the Oregon Tort Claims Act would give us. I'm a little concerned about how far it goes, how those iterations beyond that. Other than that, I'm not sure I'm prepared, I guess, or qualified to speak specifically to your question.
Well, I can understand, Mr. Chair, I can understand why you would say that there's questions out there, yeah. And you know, how broad that we should look at. But I guess I would go what I'm asking you is beyond that is, do you think this is an important enough issue that we should do something about it or try to find a solution so that these types of situations that have been articulated here don't occur? Or is this not, is it more important just to muddle the issue and not deal with it? I guess that's why I'm asking. Is this an important enough issue do you feel needs to be dealt with at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, with the example given, I don't have the knowledge to know how much of an issue that is. In my experience working with Marion County, and on our occasions we deal with very small children, from a point of view of the county, I don't know of any circumstances where this has been an issue. Maybe only because we haven't been confronted with it at this point. But I don't know from my experience in my county if this is particularly an issue here. But the example given to you, the kind of litigation that's involved, is just beyond my knowledge. So I don't have any knowledge to add to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right. Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Mike Dwyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I am a lawyer from Portland. I've been practicing law for 24 years, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the bill and particularly the amendment that's been submitted. I come with a pretty broad range of practice experience, and that includes sensitivity to governmental functions. I was in the United States Attorney's Office in Los Angeles in the 1980s before moving to the Northwest. I also have a sensitivity to children. I have been asked by the court in Multnomah County, Clackamas County, on many occasions to represent children in high-conflict divorce cases. I also got into the entire domestic relations arena by representing CASAs, court-appointed special advocates in juvenile court. My practice, which is a small two-person firm now, does do a lot of civil litigation, and we represent children who have been sexually abused. I want to talk about that type of, I want to bring some reality to all of this discussion, because we're not talking here about children stepping off curbs. We are talking about invisible injuries to children. Usually that invisible injury in most cases is sexual abuse. Not always. It can consist of other forms of child maltreatment. These children who are in the custody of SCF are, I know the term victim is often overused in our society today, but boy, if there is a victim, it is the children who are in the custody of SCF. They are there in the custody of SCF because they don't have parents capable of parenting them. That is why the state has stepped in and taken custody of those children. Those children have parents who are, if they're around at all, are involved with drugs or other problems that make them incapable of serving as the eyes, the ears, and the voices for those children. So the only eyes and ears and voices that exist are those of SCF. And it would be ironic if we imposed a duty on SCF to blow the whistle on themselves. After all, the cases we are talking about here are cases of negligence, usually. That's what we're talking about. It's where a human being, well-meaning, but overworked and busy with SCF, has every once in a while fallen down on the job and not conducted proper oversight, not done their job. It happens. We're human beings. And in those cases where that happens, it would be ironic indeed to impose on the same person who overlooked, as a result of an overwhelmed caseload or whatever, has overlooked a particular situation, to then impose on that same person a requirement that they file a tort claim notice. It's just an impossible situation, and there really is no one else for these children to serve as their eyes and ears and voice in all of this. Now, what has been missing so far a little bit is a little bit of practicalities about what is a tort claim notice. Now, I handle lawsuits, and we have to file tort claim notices occasionally. It doesn't mean necessarily that I have a meritorious case. It may or may not indicate that. But what we do have to do in every situation where there is a potential claim against a public body is file a tort claim notice to preserve the claim, because if I don't just send that letter to the right person in a timely fashion, that claim is lost forever. And you can start to see the problem for the children, because there is no one around serving as the eyes and ears and voice in the time period that the law requires to file the tort claim notice. As Mr. Kramer said, that's generally 180 days, but it's extended for 270 days for children. The prior speaker mentioned that there was an extension for minors, but in all seriousness, what is the difference between 180 days and 270 days, if I got my days right, for a five-year-old child who's been sexually abused? Does that extension of time really mean anything? It means nothing at all. The tort claims notice is a letter that I send to the statute tells me who I have to send it to. It could be to the state, it could be to a county administrator, could be to an attorney. It's very important who you send it to and that that be done correctly. Now, I could well imagine a well-meaning aunt or somebody who may think that there's some claim here, something's gone wrong, sending a letter to SCF and saying, gee, there's something wrong here. Well, that's not going to cut it. SCF is not an appropriate body to receive a tort claim notice. There are very technical requirements about how you do it. The notice itself is not all that complicated. It requires that I set forth, to the best of my ability, the approximate date or dates that a claim arose, the best circumstances I can for what has happened, you know, just try to put them on notice as to the potential claim. That serves all kinds of purposes, and that's valid. But obviously, one of them, if the point is to put them on notice of the claim, isn't that notice served well by if SCF has custody of the child? This is not a situation where SCF is unfamiliar with the case. The state is unfamiliar with the case, and the lack of notice is going to prejudice the state. Indeed, if anybody knows what's going on in this child's life, it should be SCF, and therefore they shouldn't be prejudiced by the kinds of things you worry about, the loss of evidence down the road, the lack of witnesses, etc. Indeed, what they're doing is having to examine themselves. They've got their own files, etc., and that is... you know, that's what the notice would allow them to do, is take a look at the facts of the case. Well, if this amendment, the bill as amended, would go through, they already have the facts of the case. It's their own conduct that is being evaluated and investigated in this kind of case. So it seems to me that this kind of bill would fix what is a really weird situation in court, where you take a case like this and the Attorney General for the state argues something as crazy as we didn't give notice to ourselves. And we are then forced to go in and provide fairly creative arguments to overcome this hurdle and hope and cross our fingers that we get a brave judge who is willing to stick his neck out and do the right thing, the clearly right thing, but to have to do it without clear guidance from the legislature, which is a hard thing to do. A note about the retroactivity. Again, the tort claim notice at the present time is 270 days for minors. By making the amendment retroactive, it would allow those children who have already had a claim accrue but have no eyes, ears, or voice to file their claim and put them on equal footing with any child who tomorrow, after the bill is passed, would have a claim and have the tort notice dispensed with. It is just good policy, it's just fair, and it takes out of the system a very awkward, unfair situation that we're facing these days. One final word. The prior speaker seemed to be concerned more than anything, as I heard him respectfully, with kind of what we call a floodgates argument, that if you do this for these children, who knows what's next. But this is Mr. Kramer's case was not unique, but this is hardly a situation that comes up over and over and over again. These cases are very difficult from a lawyer's perspective. I'll tell you, you've got a tort cap on it. In most cases, you're facing a tort cap of $100,000. Most of these cases are not economical to begin with, and some lawyers stick their necks out and try to go to bat for a child to try to get them something in their pocket when they've been damaged and hurt. I had another point, but I forgot it, and I think I'll finish with that. Thank
Senator
you very
Miller
much.
Has a tendency to do that to all of us when it comes to the room.
Thank you.
Kathy, did you want to make a couple of comments? For some reason, maybe because you sign up a lot, you're kind of last on the list here, unfortunately. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. To be brief, this is a problem with the law. As Senator Brown told you, there are many kids that are in SCF or OYA care that don't have attorneys, but even when the child has an attorney, if it's an attorney such as at the Juvenile Rights Project, we have our malpractice insurance is limited to our work in juvenile court. What happens is if we have filed the tort claim notice, the county then starts to try to negotiate with us. We can't negotiate the case because our malpractice wouldn't cover that. So we're then in a situation of trying to get the county to talk to someone else. The other thing that we then have to do is hunt around for a civil attorney for this child to take the case. Mr. Kramer's one that we often call. To get the case. So in the meantime, what's happening is the county's calling us to negotiate. We're trying to find a civil attorney to take the case, and it gets to be a situation where the lawyers in our office are handling things that they don't know about, they don't have the expertise in, yet they're trying desperately to protect the rights of the child that they have by giving notice to an agency that has custody of them. The other thing to realize is we also have to give notice to SCF, because even if our child tells us I was abused in the foster home, that's child abuse. We're mandatory reporters, so we have to call and give SCF notice. So SCF knows that something's gone on. They're required by law to go and investigate that. So the investigation does start to happen as soon as we know about it and make the mandatory report. Yet we also have to file a tort claim notice, which then gets into this whole problem.
Okay, so we need to end real quick, but what I hear you saying is that the time to time you do file a tort claim notice on behalf of the child you represent, so you're uneasy with that because of your malpractice insurance.
That's correct, Ms. Chair, and I also have to say there have been times that our attorneys, not knowing that a tort claim notice needs to be filed, have not filed the tort claim notice in a reasonable amount of time because they just don't know that area of law. We now have, personally in JRP, we have a policy of what we're supposed to do, but I have to say this is about the fourth policy we've had on this issue since I've been working there for the past 11 years. So it's just no one knows, none of the juvenile court lawyers know what they're supposed to do in this matter to protect the kids.
All righty then. All right. Thank you. Any other comments from the committee? Not. We're adjourned.